More Americans see and feel the devastation in big cities, small towns, coastlines, and in farmlands, in red states and in blue states.
After 4 years of climate denial and an embrace of fossil fuels under former President Trump, President Joe Biden is looking to clean up the country's energy policy. On his first day in office, Biden signed a number of executive orders reversing course on everything from the Paris Agreement to the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. And though climate activists and others are celebrating these efforts, not everyone is on board. Some Republicans, including U.S. Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, have alleged that Biden's recent climate actions jeopardized tens of thousands of jobs in the U.S., specifically citing the halting of the 1,200-mile pipeline.
In his first actions, President Biden managed to kill thousands of jobs and paralyze America's industries. This is an economic, energy, and national security disaster, in my view.
The debate over Keystone is raising questions about what kinds of jobs will be lost and what kinds of jobs will emerge under the Biden administration's environmental policies.
A key plank of our Build Back Better recovery plan is building a modern, resilient climate infrastructure and clean energy future that will create millions of good-paying union jobs, not $7, $8, $10, $12 an hour, but prevailing wage and benefits.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and the tension between the climate crisis and the jobs crisis is where we start today on The Takeaway. Heather Richards is an energy reporter with E&E News. Heather, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Jason Walsh is the executive director of the Blue Green Alliance, which works to unite labor unions and environmental organizations. Jason, glad to have you on the show.
It's good to be here.
Heather, let's start with you. I want to play an exchange between Fox News reporter Peter Doocy and White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki that sort of gets to the core of this issue. Let's take a listen.
When is it that the Biden administration is going to let the thousands of fossil fuel industry workers, whether it's pipeline workers or construction workers, who are either out of work or will soon be out of work because of a Biden EO, when it is and where it is that they can go for their green job?
Well, I'd certainly welcome you to present your data of all the thousands and thousands of people who won't be getting a green job. Maybe next time you're here, you can present that. The president and many Democrats and Republicans in Congress believe that investment in infrastructure, building infrastructure that's in our national interests and that boosts the U.S. economy, creates good paying union jobs.
Heather, Press Secretary Psaki there sort of, deflected the issue, really. But let's get to the core of what reporter Peter Doocy is asking here. Where do the folks who stand to lose these jobs get replacement jobs?
Right. Well, I mean, it's kind of a difficult, I don't think I have a very easy answer. It's a difficult question in a way, just because there's an assumption that somebody is going to go from a pipeline to working on a wind farm or something along those lines. And it's a bit more complicated than that. Obviously, if you kill a construction project, no matter what it is, and there's some people that have a contract to be laborers on that, then they no longer have that contract, right? They have to look somewhere else for another contract, which is how pipeline workers, kind of string together their jobs. Anyway. Green jobs, on the other hand, is something that, you know, is kind of promised to come as a part of this, you know, massive kind of investment that the president has called for. So it's not a tit for tat. It's not an easy thing to say. You know, you lost your job. You lost this contract here. You're going to get a contract here, which I think is why it's difficult for her to kind of answer that.
And Heather, what is the debate about these Keystone job or losses, we should say, represent? I mean, what's the bigger picture here?
I mean, people are either on one side or the other of it, depending on what their politics are, for the most part. Pipelines have become just a very difficult topic. People who don't really follow oil and gas or these kind of issues closely probably still have an opinion on whether or not the Keystone XL pipeline should go through. And this is a debate that's going on. This particular pipeline is a debate that's been going on since 2008 when it was first proposed, but folks have kind of weighed in because if they have all these worries about climate change, and they don't want any more pipelines. They don't want any more crude moving from here to there. And folks who are on the other side of it and who support fossil fuel development into the future say, you know, this is how you, you know, this is how you get gasoline for your cars. You know, you have to move it somehow. You're not being realistic. And there's all these people that depend on this for jobs. So it's just a very difficult loggerheads in terms of people who feel one way about it and the other way about it. And Keystone XL is just one of the pipelines and one of the projects that kind of falls right in the middle of that fight.
Jason, there are, I want to bring you into the conversation here, because the Keystone Pipeline jobs, as Heather astutely points out, are very specific types of jobs. It's a specific industry. There are other industries, particularly in manufacturing, that under President Trump were sort of made at least a political priority for the president to hold on to, because many of those jobs, manufacturing jobs, had also been in jeopardy. What's the historical context for those types of jobs and how they fared in places like Detroit and Pittsburgh?
Well, I think each community, each part of the country has a slightly different history. I think in your reference to Detroit and Pittsburgh, we have to look at a history of deindustrialization in both places that was often not responded to with good policy and good public investment by elected officials, right? Bad trade policy, bad economic policy enabled some of that deindustrialization. So I think many workers and many unions are rightly leery of any kind of transition, whether we call it just transition or something else. The reality is that over the last several decades, in particular, we have not seen a major economic shift, whether it's globalization and offshoring of manufacturing or the gigification of the economy, that has been fair to workers.
And are we talking about specific kinds of workers, Jason? Are we talk, because when we talk about green jobs, to Heather's point, I think there and others are, I think the idea here is that these are jobs that we are creating a pipeline for now that will ultimately result in employment down the road. But the folks that are caught in the middle now, I guess, are what we're talking about, right? Those folks that seems to get left behind, not in some sort of future iteration of a jobs plan, but today.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, these are not just hypothetical jobs in the future, right? I mean, according to the best counts, before COVID, there were roughly 3 million Americans working in the clean energy economy. So those are real jobs. The problem is that we often have a geographic mismatch between where the majority of fossil fuel jobs are being lost and where the majority of clean energy jobs are being created. But it's not as if we have no potential response to that. We can target public investment and we can target policy in a way that spreads those jobs out. We also have to recognize that many fossil fuel jobs are often concentrated in communities that have a very narrow economic base. This is particularly true in coal communities. And so part of the public policy response has to include helping those communities diversify their economies, and not just in the energy sector, more broadly into manufacturing, into transportation, into agriculture, into tourism and recreation. And I think we also need to recognize that, like in a sector like construction, and Heather alluded to this, there are very few distinct occupations and distinct skills for green jobs versus other jobs, right? A journeyman electrician builds a utility scale solar project with largely the same set of skills that she or he builds a fossil fuel project with. And so it's really about where we're targeting our investment and how we're structuring our economy so that those workers and their skills are applied to jobs that are actually going to result in some public goods here, which includes cleaner water, cleaner air, a livable planet.
Heather, in talking about, Jason mentioned the coal industry. President Trump made a big deal about coal, bringing back coal. It was a big political point for him. But in reality, about 10,000 coal jobs were eliminated or lost. What happened?
Coal's been struggling for 10, 15 years quite seriously, and there's, you know, some of that has speeded up in the last few years. I mean, coal is being pushed out of the power sector. And this is thermal coal, coal that we burn for electricity, right? It used to be the biggest chunk of our electricity was coming from coal, and that kind of began to erode as cheap natural gas was replacing that. That's the oil and gas industry, you know, did a really good job of figuring out how to drill and use hydraulic fracturing and things like that to find oil and gas in places we never thought we would before. And so then you had this boom of natural gas and oil across the country, which pressed down the price of natural gas. So all of a sudden you had this cheap resource. Coal was no longer the cheapest resource. And that market switch was happening over time. President Trump definitely made a big deal about coal. And that, again, was kind of played into people's identities. You know, we really appreciate coal miners in this very kind of, there's a narrative about coal miners in the country that we all kind of listen to and believe in, these old workers who have done all this stuff to power the country. But the reality is, you know, there was no policy that can suddenly change a market that's in free fall. And that market has kind of continued to erode. And with that goes the jobs.
And what about the fossil fuel industry, Heather? How's that trajectory looked in recent years?
As a whole, I mean, it's complicated. Oil and gas is a bit different in the sense that it's cyclical. You know, when you have a lot of crude oil and you've produced a lot of crude oil, the price goes down. And then, you know, you have bankruptcies and layoffs. And then when the price goes up, you know, everybody gets hired back. And that kind of back and forth is the history of the oil and gas business. You know, climate change, you know, poses a really interesting question, of course, down the road. And people are looking at a very different kind of world someday in the future. Much sooner, I guess, for some people's in some people's minds than others, you know, where we have electric vehicles instead of such a heavy reliance on gasoline and diesel and jet fuel and these kind of things.
No, I was just going to ask Jason how unions were feeling about Biden's clean energy push right now.
Well, I'll give you a short answer now, but a longer one when we come back. I mean, I think the unions and the Blue-Green Alliance are extremely excited that the president recognizes that we have not just a climate crisis in this country, but also a crisis of economic inequality, and that we should be pursuing intersecting solutions to those intersecting crises. And one of the principal ways to do that is to build a clean energy future with high quality union jobs that are accessible to all Americans.
Do you see the potential for green energy jobs to potentially rectify and embrace a more diverse working pool of people?
Absolutely. But we have to be completely intentional about that, right? And it starts with the recognition that we have unacceptable systemic levels of racism and racial inequity in this country, right? And we've got to address it. We have tools and we have models for how to ensure that as we build a clean energy economy, we are actually lifting people out of poverty and making jobs more accessible. We have community benefit agreements, for example, right, which are often applied on large construction projects that include career pipelines of pre-apprenticeship to registered apprenticeship programs with local hiring so that community members where projects are being built actually get the jobs that come from that investment. We have pipelines into registered apprenticeship programs that are not just jobs and not just careers. And then I think we also have to look at the fact that unionization itself is a way in which we address inequities, right? Because one of the things that unionization does is to confront directly wage discrimination through contracts, right? So the data shows that, for example, a Black union member earns 28% more in wages on average compared to a non-union Black worker in this country. So I think we have a number of tools to address that. I think President Biden has been very clear that he sees building a clean energy future is also a way of addressing historic and current inequities. And we just got to get it done.
Let's talk a little bit about what these jobs could offer. coal and oil and gas workers can make as much as six figures, up to $100,000 a year. But so far, from what we understand, the average solar installation job pays about $45,000 a year, maybe about half that. What is it going to take for green jobs to become comparable in terms of salary, Jason, to fossil fuel jobs?
You need to close the gap in union density between clean energy jobs like solar and wind and jobs in incumbent energy sectors. Union density in solar and wind jobs is roughly 4 to 6%. That is 2 to 3 times less than union density rates in fossil electric power generation. So until we close that gap, we're not going to close the wage and benefit gap, because the single best way of doing that is to ensure that workers can collectively bargain with their employers for better wages and benefits and working conditions.
Heather, what hurdles do we expect the Biden administration to face when trying to implement their green jobs plan going forward? We're already hearing some opposition from some Republican members of Congress who are saying, who are fearing the loss of these jobs. Is there anything the Biden administration can do? I guess the first question would be, is it possible to even retrain current fossil fuel workers to be clean energy workers to participate in the current clean energy jobs that are available? And, you know, if that doesn't happen, what other hurdles will Biden face?
Retraining is a tricky issue that tends to make people pretty angry in fossil fuel country, I think. And I think to some degree, because historically that's been kind of the bone that's thrown in that direction. If people talk about, hey, we're going to move away from these fossil fuel jobs, that we can give you a training program. It's not to say training programs are bad. It's just that when we talk about a transition that affects, you know, individual workers as well as communities, we're talking about a whole kind of ecosystem. And even though those are ecosystems that are kind of stuck in certain areas, which is like what Jason referred to, you have places like, you know, Wyoming, eastern Wyoming, that are dependent on coal, parts of Appalachia that are very dependent on coal, parts of southern Louisiana that are dependent on oil. And those ecosystems are, you know, kind of complicated. So it's not, when we talk about the transition, I think one of the things that gets lost is that it's not as simple as sending somebody to a program to learn how to be a wind technician. And yes, if wind technician jobs paid as well as fossil fuel jobs, maybe that would be the number one thing that we do. But I think that when people talk about the energy transition and the challenges, and people are very realistic and very honest about what's going on, what we're talking about is, you know, what happens to the community at large, what happens to those individual workers. And you have to have, I think a lot of folks are saying, you have to have a bigger concept about what happens when you take away fossil fuel jobs. It's not that it's impossible or horrific, but it is something that has a huge impact. And I think, hopefully there is room for that in policy to understand that there's a big impact there that goes beyond retraining. So I think that there is a huge challenge in understanding that and making sure, you know, the people who are making political decisions at a high level understand that. But one of the biggest, kind of problems to that is that the people that are fighting for fossil fuel jobs are fighting for the existence of fossil fuel jobs and are not necessarily folks that are going to be saying, okay, you know, we're definitely going to lose these jobs, so what do we do for the communities? There's a disconnect in terms of how this is talked about politically that makes it hard to have these kind of honest conversations. Okay, what is happening regardless of policy? What is happening because of policy? And then what kind of policies do we put in place to help workers, to help communities that are affected by the transition?
Heather Richards is an energy reporter with E&E News, and Jason Walsh is the executive director of the Blue Green Alliance. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
We're all feeling the economic crunch from the COVID-19 pandemic, from workers who've been laid off or furloughed to businesses that have had to close their doors. But now, as many businesses face continuing losses, some say they're attempting to stay afloat in ways that consumers might find questionable. From salons to dentist offices to nursing homes, businesses around the country, some are charging hidden COVID-19 related fees for covering things like PPE, disinfection services, and other things consumers may not be aware of. Hannah Denham is a national business reporter with The Washington Post, and she's here to help us break it down. Hannah, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
What kinds of fees are we talking about generally?
So we've seen a range of fees from businesses across the country. We've seen a $5 disinfection charge in a hair salon to up to $1,200 in retroactive services for food and cleaning at a senior living center. What these fees have in common, though, is that they are often undisclosed until the customer gets a bill.
$1,200, was that something that was charged to an individual?
Yes, individuals at the senior living center were charged $1,200 each. It was later refunded after the Attorney General in Michigan took action, but that's just the most egregious example I've seen.
Hannah, how common has this practice become among different types of businesses?
So it's something that's hard to numerically track. I surveyed and reached out to attorneys general offices and financial departments in all 52 states and territories, and I found that in at least 29 of those states, consumers have filed at least 510 complaints of these surcharges at different businesses. So this is something that we can track here that's growing.
Were there certain industries and businesses that were more likely to charge these types of fees? You mentioned facilities for the elderly. Is that one of the more egregious examples that we're seeing?
That is definitely one of the more common and the most expensive surcharges I've seen. But I've also seen a lot of reports from patients at dentist offices, other doctors' appointments. We've seen it in hair salons and restaurants. So any sort of medical care facility or some sort of business that requires close contact, that's where we're seeing these PPE fees.
So thinking as a business owner, let's say you've had a tough year, no doubt about that. And, you know, adding to that pressure is now the fact that many of these outlets and many of these businesses do, as you mentioned, have close contact and have to be safe. So is it unfair to charge consumers?
It's definitely been rough for businesses. The cost of PPE has gone up dramatically. That's why the American Dental Association says that dentist offices are often charging these fees. And for the restaurant industry, coronavirus fees are sometimes a way to sort of offset the increased expenses that they have to operate under restricted occupancy. So yeah, extra fees aren't fun, especially when they're a surprise. So I think what consumers really hope for from these businesses is that they're disclosed upfront.
Why is it that consumers are picking up these fees? Why aren't the federal, state, and local government doing something to help businesses mitigate some of these additional costs?
I think that's a question that both consumers and businesses are asking. CARES funding has run out for a long time for a lot of these businesses, especially those who are locally owned. Funding for local and state governments is even hard to come by. So I think this is a situation that consumers are frustrated that they're sort of picking up the bill on. But in the case of dentist offices and other medical care facilities charging these fees, the issue really should fall with the insurers to cover these fees for the healthcare providers in their network. And that's what a lot of state governments are encouraging right now.
Hannah, how likely is it that insurance companies will actually agree to cover additional charges? Could this become standard practice going forward to take on these additional charges?
It definitely depends on the state and the insurance policies that are in practice there. At least in New York, it is legally required for these insurers to refund any customers that have any patients that have had to pick up these fees and to encourage the healthcare providers in their network to stop charging these fees if they have done so. But it really does depend on the state.
You're using the word encourage. I have a couple questions there. Number one, a lot of folks may not even be aware that they're being charged these fees, particularly. But the second thing is encouraging companies to do the right thing and requiring companies to do the right thing are two different things. Are there any states, attorneys generals that you spoke to that are now thinking of ways to create legislation to be more clear about how companies, what the limits are in charging consumers these types of fees?
You're right. It's legally really murky because a lot of these states don't actually have laws that protect against hidden fees or even price gouging, which some feel like this is an instance of because we're in a public health crisis. So some of these states did adopt price gouging laws in March at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, but not all have these laws. So it really depends on the state. In California, we know that hidden fees are illegal. In New York, the Department of Financial Services is taking legal action to keep insurers in check, but it really does depend on the jurisdiction of where you live.
How much of a choice do consumers have? I mean, you have a choice to say you don't want to dine at this establishment because you don't want to pay that fee, right? That could be a choice. But if you're at a dentist or doctor's office, that you're there for work that needs to be done, you've taken the time off, your insurance has approved the visit, and now you're being told you need to pay this additional fee, consumers may not have a choice in the matter. Is there anything that can be done to prevent that from happening, to giving consumers a choice?
That is definitely the issue here. I talked to one woman in Ohio who was charged the $10, I believe, coronavirus fee at her dentist office for services that she had not received yet. She refused to pay the fee, and now the dentist office is refusing to continue with her dental surgery that she needs. And so she just feels like she's in a bind. She's reported it to the attorney general's office, but so far nothing has happened, and she just feels like stuck. And I think a lot of consumers, it doesn't feel like a choice if this fee is being slapped on at the end of the bill. So I think that one thing you can do is report the issue to the attorney general, to any sort of financial regulator that you have locally. But even then, that takes time and there's no promise of being refunded. So it really is a tough situation for these consumers.
Hannah, once long ago, and I'm being silly when I say long ago, it was only a couple of years ago, particularly under the Obama administration, there was something called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was supposed to look at these issues. The Federal Trade Commission might in some ways look at these issues. What does Washington have to say about this?
I have not heard anything from Washington on this front. I think this is something that's really still early to track. I've only been able to sort of find out the current number of complaints in the 29 states because I went to every single attorney general in every state for months. But this is hard to track. It's largely anecdotal up to this point. And so I think it'll take some time before federal regulators really take notice. But I think that is something consumers are hopeful of.
And is there any last minute advice for consumers who find themselves in that position? You said contact your attorney general. Any other pieces of advice? Or for businesses who want to charge these fees, how should they be doing it more transparently?
I think what consumers are asking of these businesses is to just disclose the fee if they have one up front. For restaurants, if that's on the menu or on a sign on the door. For dentist office, if they're calling for your appointment to let you know on the phone, there's an extra fee. And I think consumers, any advice I would give is to just ask questions. Maybe this is something you should ask of businesses that you are patrons at moving forward.
Hannah Denham is a national business reporter with The Washington Post. Hannah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. As states continue expanding their vaccine priority groups to people in specific age groups and professions, some people with disabilities are finding themselves excluded. In November, research published by the nonprofit group Fair Health indicated that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities were 2 to 3 times more likely to die after contracting COVID-19 than those without those disabilities. And while states including New York and Ohio have placed people with disabilities in their very top priority groups, others like California are lagging behind.
California's current vaccination plan prioritizes residents based on age, but not by disability or underlying medical conditions. Dr. Kara Ayers is an assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati and the director of the Center for Dignity and Healthcare for People with Disabilities. Kara, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Andy Imparato, executive director of Disability Rights California. Andy, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Kara, what's the definition of disability? Who are we talking about?
Well, that has clearly been a hard question for the states to answer as well. I, as a researcher and also a proud disabled person myself, think of it very broadly, recognizing that it impacts, you know, disability includes people with chronic conditions, you know, whether they're acquired or like myself, born with a disability. So the definition is quite broad, but states have approached it differently. Our collaboration with the Center for Dignity and John Hopkins Disability Health Research Center, we tracked all 50 states to see how each state defined disability. And there are really no two states that are alike. And that has caused some of the confusion because even people with disabilities themselves have a hard time knowing how their state classifies or defines disability.
Andy, what are some of the most significant risks that people with disabilities are facing during the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the challenges that a lot of folks in California have had is they get services in their home from workers who are coming in, and sometimes the workers get exposed to COVID and bring the COVID with them into the home. So, you know, it's not just do you have an underlying health condition that might make you more likely to die from COVID, but do you have kind of the nature of the services that you get as a person with a disability? Does that make you at greater risk of getting COVID? And both of those issues are playing out in California right now, which is why we're trying to get our governor to prioritize people who are high risk, who are under 65 and have disabilities.
And what are some of the factors, Andy, as we mentioned at the top, that people with disabilities, intellectual and developmental disabilities, might even have higher death rates from COVID-19? How does that factor into the broader conversation?
Right. Well, a lot of folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities have other comorbidities besides their primary disability. They may be higher weight. They may have diabetes. They may have pulmonary issues. So it's not just the primary diagnosis, but it's looking at the person's whole situation. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of people in California who've been afraid to go out of their homes or their apartments since March of last year because they're afraid they're going to die if they get COVID. So we're saying to the state, let's prioritize them for vaccines so that they can get their lives back and so they don't have to live in fear of dying from COVID.
Kara, we are hearing different things, as you said. Even states individually have different ways of categorizing disabilities and who is eligible for the vaccine as a result. Are there any states, Kara, that have done a better job than others at prioritizing people with disabilities in their vaccination plans?
There have been some states that stand out in both their classification of disability broadly and recognizing, as Andy mentioned, that there's so many different conditions that can intersect and we really have to consider the whole person. So I find that to be more equitable than kind of this list of diagnoses, because you're always going to leave someone off that list, and especially people with rare conditions who, you know, those conditions don't have the numbers to necessarily stack up the research, but that doesn't mean that their risks of death are any less than the groups that have. So you definitely see bias creep in. You know, a recent study also showed the high risk of people with schizophrenia, and we know the stigma faced by individuals with schizophrenia, and we don't see them listed in any plans. But I am impressed by plans that also recognize the barriers to accessing the vaccine themselves. So plans like Oregon's directly identify approaches like drive-up vaccine centers, which addresses the transportation barriers that many people with disabilities face. The number one thing that stands out to me in the plans that I think are doing a good job is that you can see that the disability community was a part of the decision-making process. And in the states that just to our community have obvious errors and are huge omissions, I think there was less involvement of people with disabilities and their family, and that's clear.
Andy, we talked a little bit about the higher death rates, but what about poverty? What about low-income people with disabilities? Are they, in California in particular, are they more at risk for not being vaccinated or having access to the vaccine?
No question. I mean, you know, we talked about social determinants of health. And if you have a disability, you're more likely to live in poverty. And if you live in poverty, you're more likely to have a disability, in part because you don't have great access to healthcare or nutrition. So yes, no question that when we talk about the high risk people in California, we're talking about disproportionately low income people and people of color who also have disabilities.
And Kara, to that point, the disability rights community is asking for more research on how COVID-19 is affecting people with disabilities. What kind of data are you looking for? Is it race? Is it socioeconomics? What is it?
We're looking for all of those variables because it really is important to consider the whole person. But I mean, and COVID-19 has really magnified problems that we already knew existed, including in the data that we collect. Even collecting disability status is something that isn't happening at a healthcare level in many cases. So we aren't able to answer the simple questions of how many people with this condition die with COVID. And then we're asked to answer that question in advocacy circles where we're asking for that prioritization because we're seeing it in our communities and we need the data to back it up.
I am the mother of a 24-year-old daughter with a pronounced intellectual and developmental disability. We live in LA County, an extremely restricted county due to the rampant spread of COVID-19. I have not been able to get a COVID-19 vaccine for my daughter. We are African Americans. I don't know if she's going to be fortunate enough to get the vaccine in time enough to prevent her from getting infected and having a horrible outcome because we're in LA County and she's not 65. She's being told she can't get it.
Andy, that was a caller from LA County who really describes the situation exactly as a daughter that has a disability and she cannot get the vaccine. What is happening in California with the vaccine rollout?
So I want to go back to something Dr. Ayers said earlier, which is that when the state works with the disability community, they usually make better decisions. So in the context of California, the state is doing that. They have a number of us from the disability community on their vaccine advisory committee. The problem is that they're not listening to us. We've been telling them for weeks that they need to prioritize high risk people with disabilities who are under 65 or people will unnecessarily die. And they're telling us, yeah, that makes sense, but we want to come up with a great plan for how to reach them. And we got to do the over 65 population first, but you're next. But they won't tell us what next means. So we're trying to get them to commit to a time frame. And so far, we've been unsuccessful.
And what has Governor Newsom said, Andy, about this this issue? What's his response been?
So Governor Newsom was asked about specifically about people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, like the family that called in on Monday when he did a press conference in San Diego at a vaccine site. And he said, I'm very aware of this problem. I'm working on it with my Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Mark Galli, and we will make an announcement about this later this week. So again, we're really hoping that they're not just going to say you're next, but they're going to say starting next week, we're going to vaccinate high-risk people under 65 and the folks who get services from our regional centers, which are people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, are going to be one of the groups that we prioritize quickly.
Kara, one of the things that has stood out to me, particularly as here in New York, many people scramble to try to find, you know, spending hours, days, weeks looking for vaccine appointments for their elderly friends and family. Some of them said they had to drive, you know, at least an hour, if not more, wait on lines for multiple hours. That seems almost impossible if you are someone who doesn't have your own transportation and who cannot stand in a line for multiple hours. What are some of the challenges for the disability community to actually get to vaccine distribution points?
Yes, you highlighted some of the many challenges, and I think the uncertainty that we've heard across states too about supplies and how much each site is going to get has also amplified this problem. So we've heard stories of people who have somehow overcome all the barriers you mentioned in terms of setting up transportation, arranging a support person perhaps to go with them, and then they arrive to the appointment to be told that the supply has run out and it's canceled. And something like that can make the difference between someone getting a vaccine and not. So we really have to think more creatively and recognize barriers like transportation, but also how would someone with a disability schedule this if they weren't able to read on the website? The information is not presented in a very accessible way across many states. How would someone
schedule?
And Kara,
that's for people that's for people who know how to use the internet.
Right.
I was on my, multiple sites for my parents trying to navigate, and I was confused. I can't imagine the additional layers of difficulty if someone does not have ease or ability to access these internet, these websites.
Exactly. And some of them are just blatant violations also of disability rights to access public materials that are necessary for our health. And when you think about people who are blind who access websites with screen readers, some of these vaccine plans are hidden within the website, or, they've created highly visual graphics, which may be helpful for some people, but may make it completely inaccessible for other people to find out when they're even eligible for a vaccine, much less the tedious process of scheduling that we're all struggling through right now.
Andy, why do you think the disability community has not gotten the appropriate attention that it should during many of these vaccine rollout plans, particularly in California? Why are they now catching up and at least considering, as you mentioned, Gavin Newsom saying he's aware of the issue and expects to make some sort of announcement? But why did it take this much noise for this community to be recognized?
Well, I guess, there's two big problems in California and in other states. One is that the public health system, the people that are making a lot of these decisions are physicians, epidemiologists, folks who've been trained in public health, and they do not have deep knowledge of the disability community. They don't know where folks are. They don't know the underlying conditions that are likely to lead to death from COVID. We've had weak leadership from the CDC on these issues. So part of it is the public health system has failed the disability community in part because they don't know us as well as they should. And the other part is politics. I just don't think we have enough political power to force our governor to prioritize us. And that's, so we're making a lot of noise to change that. But it does feel like we're not important enough politically to prioritize us to be able to save our lives.
And of course, Andy, there are people who are caregivers for people with disabilities who have been prioritized, but that's still a disconnect.
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges, so California is prioritizing caregivers, including family caregivers, which is great. But it doesn't solve the problem because caregivers can refuse the vaccine. Everybody in California who's been offered the vaccine has the opportunity to say no. So if a caregiver is saying no, the person with a disability is still at risk. Plus, the science is not clear that even if you've had the vaccine, you still might be able to transmit it to the person you're taking care of. So we want them to not just do the caregivers, but also do the folks who are receiving the care at the same time.
Andy Imperato is the Executive Director of Disability Rights California, and Dr. Kara Ayers is the Director of the Center for Dignity and Healthcare for People with Disabilities. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you today, folks, and we really appreciate you all tuning in. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast, and you can download that wherever you find your podcasts, or head over to thetakeaway.org. And of course, if you have any thoughts or ideas for the show, send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. I'm at Tanzina Vega. And we can also take your voice memos, record those on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or give us a call the old-fashioned way at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. And leave us your take there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll be back tomorrow.